My name is John. I'm currently in my early 80s. I was born in Danbury in 1933. I have very pleasant memories of coming to Malden when I was a youngster, between about 4 and 5, 6, 7 years old, particularly during the war. My mother came from Great Totham, where she had a sister, and we frequently visited the sister on a bus route that ran from Southend to Clacton on an hourly basis. One route ran through Danbury, the other route went another way before it got to Malden. So it's very, very convenient to pick up this bus to go to Malden. It was a double decker, and I had at that time three other brothers, and we used to all go off as a tribe and sit on the front seat upstairs.
Were you allowed to travel on your own as boys, or did your mother come with you?
Yes, I travelled around quite a lot on my own when I was quite young. That wasn't a great problem in those days. I suppose my mother was pleased to get rid of some of us and have a bit of a rest and do other things whilst we weren't there. Anyway, there used to be when we went through Woodham Mortimer, where in actual fact my aunt taught at the school there for 13 or 14 years and used to cycle from Great Totham every day to the school there. We then go downhill and get a marvellous view of Malden, and particularly when the tide was in and it was a sunny day, it was this great glinting mass of water. But the thing I remember best of all was Malden wasn't built up then. It was quite open. Some of the houses that we are there now obviously were there then. But along Spittle Road, which was the bus route, nothing much registered until what we call the villas, which is the row of quite late Victorian houses, which ran from the what was then the workhouse up to Ware Pond. And these were in very much better condition then than they are now, although the railings had been taken away at the beginning of the war. And incidentally, I now live in one of these houses, and there's still evidence of railings that I find in my front garden. That was great fun. We knew we were then in Malden, and we could either then go down the High Street on the bus, get off at the bus station, which was quite a large terminus where all the buses took off for Denji and other places.
And where was that in the High Street?
About three quarters of the way down where, I can't remember, there's an old person's home being built there now. There was a waiting room there, where if you went inside, you could hear all of the local dialects from the villagers. And if you were keen enough and knew something about them, you could pick out and identify people from where they came from. They're waiting for a bus back home.
Is that where Embassy Court now is?
I think, yes, I believe it, yeah. Yes.
There was a cinema there, was there, at one time?
The cinema, no, the Embassy Court. Oh no, the cinema was a bit higher up. Well, the one great treat is when we got to the bus station was to ask permission from the conductor, because there was a conductor on the bus and a driver as well, whether we could stay on the bus, because he went into the garage and turned round to come back on its journey to go on to Clacton, or if we go the other way back to Southend. It's a great treat to sit on this front seat and be right up high and looking at the construction of the garage. It's a very large garage. It took a lot of buses. And invariably we were allowed to have this treat, which is quite simple really, but as being boys, we, you know, we thought it terrific. We then went down, then the bus went off down Market Hill, which again was another treat.
Was that your first introduction then, do you think, and first interest in buildings and constructions?
I'd always been interested in how things work and how things are put together, so it was a contributing factor, yes.
John, what are your memories of the Prom Park as a boy?
Oh, this was great excitement because the Prom, we had, it was a stretch of water that you could paddle in without fear of being drowned unless you went into the deeper areas where the diving boards were. There was sand to play in, which was replenished every year. One time, before they fell into dereliction, they used to have diving boards, two or three different heights. Mm. We used to watch the divers dive off these. Ice creams and other things like that. The beginning of the war, one of the things that disappeared were ice creams. And I believe in the earlier stage of the war, when things were very jumpy, when Hitler was going to invade, or this fear of invasion, some of these areas were restricted. So if you deliberately went down to the Prom Park for a day by the seaside, in inverted commas, the police would sometimes get on the bus and inspect your baggage, and if you had towels, you were turfed off the bus and you had to go back home again.
Why weren't you allowed to swim then?
It wasn't much so much swimming as restricting movement of people. That, I think, was during the, particularly during the period when there was risk of invasion. And also, they didn't encourage sort of unnecessary travelling. There was a watchword was, is your journey really necessary? I think it applied more on the railways than it did for local people.
Was there much army activity in the area?
Oh, yes. There was a lot of forces billeted around, including the Air Force as well, particularly when the Americans came and started building airfields locally, particularly at Borum. But anyway, that's if you went down to the Prom. Most of the journeys we continued on from Malden into Great Totton, where my aunt lived. It was great excitement sitting on the front seat of the double-decker bus going down Market Hill, because very, very steep. And the great treat was when we got to the railway station, hoping that the train would be leaving or coming into the station and the bus would be held up at the level crossing so we could get a view of the locomotive in full steam, chuntering away.
And where was that, the level crossing, related to now?
That was near where
Tesco's,
yes, that area there. I think the road that, the main road that runs at right angles to the causeway, that was part of the railway track anyway. It was turned into a road subsequently. We then moved on to Great Totton. Not much to say about the journey there. This was quite a short journey. Well, Broad Street Green Road was interesting because that was a long straight road. We weren't used to seeing straight roads because most of the roads we encountered in the country were very bendy and windy, having gone round existing fields.
Can I bring you back to Malden?
Yes.
Can I ask if, you know, what you remember of the High Street? Maybe not too much if you're a young boy. But
Yes, some of the video, some of the Powells, I think, was a merchant that dealt in seeds and animal foods and things like that at the top of the high street, because one of our neighbours at Danbury used to keep rabbits, and she used to buy her hay and other things from Powells, or chicken food. If you kept chickens, you could give up your chicken ration and were allowed to have so much chicken food. If you had too many eggs, or there was a restriction on number of eggs, you had to give them to the egg marketing board, I think. So these old ladies, the chickens were so... it was just chickens to them. They didn't really know what they were doing. But anyway... Powell's, so it's one of the shops I remember.
And Powers?
Powell's, P-O-W-E-L-L-S.
Powell, yeah.
Powell's. And, of course, the other big shop, I can't remember the name of it now, is where, not Pound Stretchers, Wenlock's. That used to be a very, very large departmental store.
Wenlock's.
Sold nearly everything. And of course the activities in the high street were slightly more domestic now than they were.
Was Wenlock's where the Emporium now is?
Yes, right. Yes, that's right. So basically the high street wasn't so much of interest to us. Mm. Some of the other activities, i.e. the prom or going to Great Totham.
Did your mother come to Malden for shopping, or did she stay in Danbury?
We stayed in Danbury, and the shopping came to us.
Oh.
Ansell's, the butchers, used to, even during the war, had a delivery to us at Danbury on Wednesdays and Saturdays. And soon after the war started, they had a land girl who used to drive the meat van called Nancy. And I made friends with her, and as a treat, she used to take me on her delivery rounds.
And Ansell's, it was where it is now, at the top, yes, of the high street, same premises.
And before the advent of war, Mr. Ansell himself used to come round in a van and carve up the meat on the van itself. And the great treat, we used to wait for him to turn up, my brother Peter and myself, and he used to cut off a piece of delicious steak and give to us to eat raw, and we'd run behind the shed and eat it. And years later, I mentioned this when Mr. Ansell retired and went to live in Malta.
Yeah.
And he still regaled the shop with that tale.
Is this your secret of being so fit and healthy in your 80s?
I'm just good luck, I think. My name is John Kame. I was born and bred in Danbury in April 1933, and I've now reached the age of today of 84.
John, you've been kind enough in the past to tell us about your memories and stories of boyhood in Malden and Danbury. Now you're going to tell us about your experiences as a young man in the Home Guards.
Yes. Early in 1950, when I was a mid to late teenager, I was an architectural student, and with national service looming in the future, which I had made preparation for, but 2 or 3 years hence, the Home Guard, the post-war Home Guard was formed, and I thought I better do my bit prior to doing national service for king and country. You may say, well, we thought that the Home Guard finished at the end of the war. Well, it did, but with the ensuing political situation after the war, in other words, the Cold War, with the advent of the atomic bomb, the spread of communism, it was a very unsettled period. And Winston Churchill, who came in on the second period after the war, he lost the election immediately after the war, but he came back for the second one. He was instrumental in bringing back or reforming the Home Guard, basically on the same way as it was formed during the war, as part of the civil defence plan to combat the spread of communism and also the risk of Russian airborne invasion, which he felt was likely to happen. It's one thing looking back and say, well, you know, it didn't, which was true, but anyway, so I decided I'd do my bit and join the Home Guard.
You were quite a young man, quite a teenager when you joined. Well, what motivated you to actually join the Home Guard?
Well, I felt I ought to do my bit and learn something about the ways of the military, because it was a semi-military affair, the Home Guard, before I did my national service. I don't know why, but I was rather keen to do it. So I went along and I was accepted. I was perhaps the youngest one. I joined a unit in Danbury. We had our own local unit in Danbury, which had a second lieutenant in charge and a sergeant and a corporal and a few others. It wasn't up to strength because the take-up for the Home Guard wasn't as great as Churchill expected. But anyway, we were all very enthusiastic. I was the youngest one in the unit, being a late teenager, and pretty well all of the others had military experience because they'd taken part in the war. So, but I was, as I said, I was keen, and we had training on the Piat obsolescent anti-tank gun, which was quite a bit of equipment. You had to lie on your back and cock it with pushing it with your feet and pulling with your hands, and there was a knack, and quite often you got halfway there and, you know, it took control of you rather than you of that. Well, we got the hang of it in the end. We were also trained on the Bren gun, which was a superb piece of equipment. We had to do this blindfolded or at night time because it was a very, very efficient piece of equipment, and there are many instances where we were using it. We had to change the barrel as well if it got overheated. We practiced throwing hand grenades, albeit dummy ones, spending most of the time looking for the bits that flew off so we could reconstruct them again. I think we also had Thompson submachine guns, but I don't remember much about them. We were taught field craft. All this took place in the scout's hut.
Did you wear a uniform?
Yes. It was based on the army uniform, and I think we had a blue beret. We looked almost like a soldier. We didn't have the complete equipment that they carried around, but pretty well so. We also had a 303 rifle allocated to us. Now, that being a lethal weapon, was stored in an armoury at the village hall and looked after by an ex-soldier. We drew on that as necessary because there were times we went on parade where we had, and particularly at weekends, where occasionally we went to Colchester Barracks for the weekend on the firing range. And of course, once you fired a rifle, either with live ammunition, which we did on the firing range, or with dummy rounds if you're doing an exercise, It all had to be meticulously cleaned. Otherwise, the barrel would rust up, and then, you know, it's a piece of equipment that had to be looked after. Well, basically, our training took place during the week, I think one day a week. Most weekends, we came and maybe joined another branch and carried out exercises. Particular favourite was coming to Malden and joining the Malden Home Guard outfit, doing exercises on the what was then an unbuilt area of land to the west of the causeway, backing onto the railway and the river, and we used to exercise on that.
John, what was the actual threat? What were you training for?
Oh, it's basically the threat of Russia, who basically wanted to impose the whole of the Western civilization to communism. That was a basic threat, and they had various means of achieving that. And we didn't want to happen in this country the thing that had happened to nations adjoining Russia, where they all came under their influence.
And that was a threat from the sea and the sky?
Well,
everything?
Winston Churchill thought that anticipated an airborne attack of, I think, up to 70,000 parachuters coming in, which they may well have had at that time. Mm. And the Home Guard would have been one of the first lines of defence. It would have been there and ready for them. Mm. It wouldn't have succeeded in overcoming such a trained force as the Russians, but it would have hampered their progress, probably giving sufficient time for the real army to take charge of things. I think a lot of the Home Guard would be hived up in secret bunkers like they were during the war.
And how would you have been contacted should this have happened?
We would have been contacted verbally. I don't know, I suppose radio.
Mm.
There'd been a warning.
Mm.
Yeah.
And you came to Malden, as you say, fairly often.
Yes, weekends, Colchester for
Every
trip.
Weekend you had some commitment for the Home Guard?
I'm not sure that it was every weekend, but
most.
It's quite serious, yes.
Mm.
Yeah, and...
And you were training, you said, alongside where the causeway is and where now we have lots of factories
and
buildings. That, at the time, was...
Seemed to be a favourite place because it was in the open. The area was slightly undulating, so we could practice all sorts of things, hiding up, camouflage.
Mm. And Malden's Home Guard, was it about the same size as Danbury? Or
no, Malden's Home Guard, I think, was a lot larger.
Right.
Yeah, and we also went to one or two other destinations, one of which was, I think, I've forgotten the name of the place now.
Can you tell me a little bit more about perhaps your training with the Malden group? Did you, for instance, go out in boats, or were you have any?
No, we
training
we,
about?
I don't remember going out in boats at all. Mm. It was all land based.
Right, preparing for a possible. Attack, I suppose, by boats on this country, as in the Second World War?
I don't know of any marine oriented Home Guard outfits,
okay.
But I think Churchill's view that it would be an airborne invasion,
right. Yeah,
which precluded boats.
Of course, yeah. So that was the priority.
Yeah.
Being aware of parachutes.
Parachutes, yes.
So I know you've got a lovely story about the final parade.
Yes.
Now, was that was right at the end of the period of the Home Guard then?
Yeah. After, I'm not sure how many years I was in the Home Guard, but a relatively short period, I think. Mm. It didn't last for very long because I think the threat had diminished somewhat, and it was costing the country quite a bit of money to run the Home Guard, although in modern day terms it was a drop in the ocean. Mm. But we were pretty hard up after the war and for the number of years after the war, and it was a colossal expense that the government felt they couldn't afford. So the threat wasn't as bad as it was when the Home Guard was first formed, and it was decided they'd have stand down and I think virtually mothball it to some extent. And so there was a final date when the final parade happened, and we decided, or the Home Guard decided, that based in Malden and branches there around about, we would meet in the Swan and have a good supper and then an entertainment cabaret afterwards. We were each told that we could take a partner along with us. So the person that was overall charge in this area was Brigadier Peyton Reed. He came from Braxton. And it so happened that by that time, as an architectural student, I'd moved to London to the Architectural Association, and I met Peyton Reed's daughter, Iona, who was also an architectural student at another college in London. So we decided we'd go along to the final parade and not mention it to her father. So until she turned up with me at the final parade to the dinner, nobody knew who I was bringing. It's not quite the done thing because... Anyway, it was great fun. She enjoyed the joke, and I don't know whether her father did, but...
He was a little surprised.
He was surprised, yes. we had, as I say, had a good dinner, then settled down for the cabaret. We got about halfway through that when the compere collapsed on the stage with a heart attack and died. The curtain came down, and that was the end of my time in the Home Guard.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes.
What a very sad, dramatic ending
to it all.
It
was, yes, yeah.
Gosh.
Yeah, and
after
that we had a scroll from George VI thanking us for our efforts, which unfortunately is now lost, but that was the only evidence really that I had been in the Home Guard.
And years later, then you did your national service?
Probably 3 years later I did my national service.
When you'd finished your training?
When I finished my architectural training, yes. Yeah.
And so do you think your experience in the Home Guard helped? It must have helped.
Well, it,
in your
it
national
did
service.
Because I knew something about some of the training we'd done in the Home Guard. Mm. But being in the Royal Engineers, it was... A lot of it was technically orientated, which I was rather keen on.
Yeah. I don't think perhaps many people realise that the Home Guard was set up again after the war.
Very few people did, and nobody will believe me when I say, except now with the internet, you can check up these things on the internet, so it's been recorded there.
So... How many years would you say it was in existence after the war? You said starting in the early 1950s.
I should probably think about 4 or 5. It didn't suddenly all finish at once, but it...
Oh, that's lovely.
There was lots of equipment, of course, left over from the war, so it wasn't a great problem.
That's really interesting, John. Thank you very much.